This is an ABC podcast.
When Jimmy Barnes was a teenager, he and some mates kicked in the back door of the Apollo Stadium in Adelaide to see Tina and Ike Turner. Jimmy made his way to the very front and he was transfixed by Tina's power, her energy, her legs. He was also mesmerised by the driving power of the band under Ike Turner's direction. The magic combination Jimmy encountered that night of soul and force and precision is what he's aimed for with his own music. There have been many times with Cold Chisel and as a solo performer that he's got there. There have also been times when other things got in the way. Booze and drugs and the demons of his troubled childhood. Over the last few years, Jimmy Barnes has been bringing those demons out into the light by writing the story of his life, first in Working Class Boy, then Working Class Man, and now in his new book, Killing Time. And a warning, Jimmy is very candid about his life story, and there are elements that some of you might find upsetting. Hi, Jimmy.
How are you going, sir?
How well do you remember that Tina Turner gig?
I remember very well. I mean, I just remember that it was inspiring. Me and my mates, by the way, we didn't particularly go see Tina Turner. We'd just go to any concert at the Apollo Stadium, which was that was where all the international acts played in Adelaide. And we were just hoodlums. And so basically we'd go there and we had this system. We knew there was about, 10 or 20 of us. So we'd kick the back door in and there was only two or three bouncers. So they could only catch a few of us. So you'd sacrifice one or two of your best friends and then you'd let the rest of us would all get in. And we used to do this almost every week. And I'd seen all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Of course, I'd heard River Deep, Mountain High, and I was a fan of that song, but I didn't really know what to expect. And when I got in there, of course, there's Tina, just looking fabulous in the front with the iCats. So I did what everybody does, I ran down the front, I got down the front, and it wasn't just, I was there and literally I was, well, it was just all these legs in front of me. It was amazing. But it, more than that, it was just the intensity that the woman sang with and the power and the commitment to what she was doing was just so, and I was standing there and I was like mesmerized by this as a young, fella, I was 14 or something. And I was started a band of my own, we were in a garage band and I was watching, I was just going, this is incredible. And I just happened for a second to gaze past these incredible women that were performing. And I seen this guy in the back and I noticed everybody in the band was watching him and he was the one that was bang, every time he moved his leg the band did an accent. It was intense and he was a taskmaster and it was Ike Turner. And so I know, and as everybody else does know, is that Ike it turned out to be a really bad cat, but he knew how to run a band. I think that drive and that power that he was demanding from his band, he probably pushed Tina harder and harder every show. And obviously because she did so much after she left Ike, she hadn't even hit full speed yet, so she was an incredible woman. And I was lucky, I watched the show and I went away and I, this is what I want to do. This is the way I want to drive a band. I want it to be that intense, that passionate, that where people cannot ignore it. And so I sort of applied that to my career forever. But I was lucky enough to work with Tina much later. And I tell you, quite often you meet people you've looked up to and, that's always nice, but they've mellowed or they don't live up to what you expected. Tina was everything and more. She was just frighteningly good.
I think by the time of that gig, you'd left school or were about to leave school. How are you making money as a teenager?
I left school and I worked in garages. We wouldn't just a couple of petty jobs. My parents wanted me to stay. My dad was sort of insisting that I sort of would only be allowed to leave school if I got an apprenticeship. But I managed to get out and then he pushed me back into school again. And at about sort of 15 and a half, I applied for an apprenticeship at the South Australian Railways. And I got a job as a moulder in the foundry. And if you don't know what that is, it's basically like metallurgy. You work with molten metal, which is, when you think of a 16-year-old taking LSD and drinking all night, going to work in a foundry the next morning, pouring molten metal at 3,000 degrees centigrade isn't a very good thing to do. But, I turned up every day. I was a pretty good apprentice, apparently. And I stayed at that job for about 6 months, and I used to hitchhike to and from the in terrible states, Sometimes I'd go straight from being out to the factory.
And outside of the factory on the streets of Elizabeth and the parts of Adelaide that you'd hang out in as a teenager, how rough did things get, Jimmy?
We just thought it was normal. It was sort of, it was rough at home. Most of these were fairly troubled homes, very poor, lots of drinking, lots of alcohol. So we were all quite used to the rough, and it was really an extension. When we got out as kids, we just did what our role models had showed us what to do. And that was, if you didn't like something, you smashed it, you know? So basically we were out in the streets, you know, it was sort of gangs, street gangs. You know, we'd all hang at the shopping center every night of the week, and we'd walk the streets and look for trouble, you know, whether it was, you know, fighting, or, you know, if people didn't want to fight us, we'd find people who did, you know? But I've got to tell you, even back then, I could fight, because you had to fight. You either were aggressive or you were a victim. And so you sort of had to do it. But my heart was never really in it. And my friends there, who were probably even more troubled than I was, I remember lots of them, when they get in these fights, it was like near death. You know, people were getting stomped in the gutters and hit with glasses and bottles and crowbars and anything you get your hands on. And I just could never do that, you know. So I learned how to fight and take people on. I worked out early that if you pick the biggest guy with the biggest mouth, can't necessarily fight. So I was smart, you know, and I'd hit the biggest guy, then that'd be all over, and I'd sort of wouldn't have to go berserk. And it was something that it just didn't sit with me as a kid. I'm essentially a gentle sort of person. So I didn't have my heart in that. And I was really always music was my way of escaping from that violence. And so I would get the gang and said, they're all, we're going to go, let's go to the pub and fight. And I said, oh, let's go to Apollo Stadium. And we'll go up there and start trouble. And basically every time we kick the door and, you know, they'd go in looking for trouble, fighting bouncers or other punters, and I'd be watching music. I remember one night we kicked the door in and went in, and I'd never heard of Bob Marley before. Bob Marley was playing, and as soon as I got in, that sort of the whole arena just smelt funny. And I'm watching, I'm going, well, this is pretty good. And then the band started, and it was just frighteningly good. You know, I've never heard a groove like it in my life. And, you know, all my mates are just looking for trouble, trying to fight hippies. And I was just going, I was learning about music every day. So in the midst of all this violence, I was still, you know, like we'd go to the coffee shop, you know, trying to pick up girls and do all that sort of stuff. And I'd be picking up songs from the radio, you know, from the jukebox. I was the odd one out.
You come from a line of fighters. Your dad was a boxer, a really accomplished amateur boxer. Tell me the story of his being allowed in a prison cell back in Scotland with a man who'd assaulted your sister.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like Glasgow justice, you know. My dad was very tough. He was featherweight champion of Britain and Scottish amateur champion, and he was a hell of a street fighter. You know, my grandfather used to fight bare knuckles in the street. They were both hard men. And it runs in the family. It ran right past me. We lived in a place called Cowcaddens, which was a pretty rough suburb at the time. But anywhere in a city, Glasgow was pretty tough. And there was a back alley, which they called a close, which was like where you put the rubbish bins. And there was the only toilet for the tenement buildings was there.
So you didn't have a toilet inside your apartment?
Didn't have a bathroom in the apartment. We'd wash in a bucket in the sink and all that sort of stuff. And you have to go down at night to the toilet, which was really dark and really frightening and really smelly. But my sister got dragged into a close by some bloke, and he tried to rape her. And, I'd have to speak to my sister, but I've never really spoke to her much about it. But anyway, they caught the guy. Some passerby intervened and stopped it, and they caught him. And at the time, my dad was Scottish champion, and the police took him down to the station, my dad, and said, this is the guy. And just put my dad inside with him, shut the door and left him for 20 minutes, you know. And, you know, it wasn't pretty. You know, violence gets violence, and you know, it's the way we were. And that sort of led to the way we grew up as kids, you know, because, you know, that's how you dealt with your problems, with violence. And, you know, I'm sure any father would have loved to have, you know, been in that position, but it doesn't really help. But my dad gave him a terrible bloody hiding.
What are your own earliest memories of Scotland?
I remember I was talking to my mum, and I said, where's this house? And I sort of painted a picture, talked to her of this house that I really remembered. And it was a kitchen with a bed set. There was the stove there, a fuel stove, and a bed set against the other wall, which was sort of recessed with a curtain in it. And I said, I remember this house. She said, you can't. And I said, well, there's no photos. What is it? She said, that's the house you were born in. And so I remember, and we moved out of there when I was like 8 or 10 months old. But I remember, and it's almost like I can almost remember, you know, being there on my mum's, you know, bosom. You know, it's one of those things. I don't know why it was really vivid to me. And so that's my earliest memory. And I've spoke to, you know, therapists and stuff since then, and they say that, you know, people who have that early of memories, it's normally due to trauma. You know, there's probably something horrible's happened in our house. I know lots of horrible things happened in our house. So I don't know what that particular thing was. But I remember very young. I remember, you know, Glasgow very well. It was a pretty frightening place for me.
What kind of noises do you remember? What were the sounds of Glasgow growing up?
I just remember it was loud. It was you know, there was trams. There was we were always out in the street because, you know, you didn't stay home with your parents because they were, you know, even at 4 years old. I remember every street had a gang, and the gang from the next street nearly killed a friend of ours and me. We were both 4 or 5 years old. They gave us a chance to run, and I ran away, and they were throwing bottles at us as I ran. And my mate froze, and they actually slashed his wrists, and he nearly died. And we were four, for Christ's sake. All I remember is that it was very dirty. It was very, very damp. It was, you know, those days, you see photos of Glasgow from the late 50s, 60s. It was like just a haze of smog from all the coal. There was, you know, shipbuilding, you know, foundries, funny enough, and every house was heated by coal. So it was all really sort of tense and tight feeling. And I just remember lots of shouting. You know, my most vivid memory of the sounds is shouting and swearing. And we lived, you know, out, there was a pub just down the street from us, and you know, every night when closing time came, there'd be brawls and women sort of getting belted by their husbands and screaming as they were trying to drag them out the pub with their kids. And you know, my mum would do the same. It was pretty horrible. But in saying that, it was funny because I left there when I was five, you know, but I didn't go back again until I was sort of 23, I think it was. And I remember I caught a train from London to Glasgow, and I got off the train, and from the time I walked from the train to where you get a taxi, halfway through the train station, this drunk guy tried to pick a fight with me, right? And I was just a stranger for no reason, just really drunk. And I was like, oh, Jesus. And then some other drunk guy came in and jumped in and saved me. Right. And they just sort of kept fighting, and I just kept walking, and I walked to the taxi, and it was like I had this strange like feeling of I'm home. this is where I grew up. This is where I belong. It's a very strange thing. I was always afraid in Glasgow. But since writing these two books and realizing, you know, because a lot of the stuff that happened to us as kids, I blocked completely out of my mind until just before I wrote these books. So I started doing therapy, really, because I was just, you know, I was going crazy, trying to, you know, I was going to drink myself to death and all that sort of stuff. And writing Working Class Boy and the therapy that led up to that really just opened up a hell of a lot. And I'd sit at my typewriter and write my computer, and I'd just start to write a story, and then suddenly all these memories would flood back, and it was like shock, you know, because they were really quite horrible and violent, and there was, you know, abuse and sexual abuse and all sorts of stuff that went on. And that sort of unlocked this door. Writing those books unlocked this door that allowed all this stuff to come out. And that's why I was so frightened of Glasgow. I was so frightened everywhere. I was frightened anywhere I went. But since writing the books, I went back to Glasgow, and I suddenly, you know, I could see it with a different light. And so if nothing else, if I gained nothing else from writing the book, it was certainly it opened my heart so that I could live and see and feel again.
Trying to partly escape that violence and poverty, your parents moved with you and your brothers and sisters to South Australia. Tell me about the place they eventually settled. Tell me about Elizabeth.
Elizabeth was a really great idea on paper. I mean, it was literally, it was a satellite city, about 20 miles, 20 kilometers or something outside of Adelaide. And really, they built the city just to give Holden's, you know, put a factory there. And I think the South Australian government did a deal with Holden's that they bought this big package of land, which was absolutely horrible land, you know, like nothing grows there. And they said, here, you can buy this cheap. And they put a factory up, and they said, and we'll give you a workforce, you know, and they built this city for migrants there. And basically Elizabeth was, you know, when I moved there, it was all neat and new and like, you know, like the new suburbs in outer Sydney and all that sort of stuff. And within, by the time we left, you know, 8 or 10 years later, it was, you know, just horrible. It was, it all run down, but initially a great idea on paper. They put it all there, and they had everybody worked at Holden's, so they were all there, and there was a pub in every sort of district, so there was plenty of places for the men to get drunk before they went home to beat their wives and all that sort of stuff. So what happened was all the problems they had in Britain, and most of the immigrants were from Northern Britain, you know, because it was a big push in Northern Britain then, and they just brought all the problems that they probably ran over. Like, I know my parents thought we could move to Australia and leave all our problems behind. You know, my dad's violence and alcoholism and, you know, whatever my mom was running from. There was all sorts of things. And they could come here and start fresh. And it doesn't work like that unless you address the issues. You know, that's what I found out as well. So it was quite a violent place.
Well, you tell a story, I think, in Working Class Boy of visiting a family friend's house, and the fight breaks out between two brothers over some cigarettes. What happened?
I think it might even have been Christmas. I've got a feeling it was Christmas, and we were there. It was friends of my dad's, and it was, you know, I was 8 or 9 or something like that. But this couple, they had two sons. One was about 17, one was 18 or something like that. They were arguing about a packet of cigarettes when we got there. It was getting quite heated, and we were just all going to sit down for dinner, and one had stormed off in the bedroom, and the door slammed, and then we're all sitting at the table, and the other brother was sitting, you know, just across the table from me. And during, you know, before the meal was served, I think, the brother came out of the bedroom and just grabbed him and slashed his brother's throat, cut his own brother's throat at the table at Christmas. And, you know, and then walked out. And I didn't hear this till later, but apparently he walked to the local shopping center, picked up a rubbish can, threw it through a shop window, and went in and opened up a pack of cigarettes and sat there and waited for the police to take him away. Luckily for him, the brother didn't die, but he was, you know, he was badly wounded, couldn't hear his voice, and he was close to death. You know, I used to see people, you know, you see people get blasted at parties and all the time. And that's my parents' friends. They had parties every Saturday night, you know, progressed, you know, more often. But every time they had a party, they always started out really great. And by the end of the night, somebody grabbed, you know, somebody else's wife's ass or something like that. And violence, it would be really violent, and there'd be blood spilt.
How did your big sister Dorothy try to keep you safe when your mum and dad were fighting?
Dot was sort of like the, because mum and dad were so caught up in their own shit, basically, they didn't care. They couldn't look after us. And so Dot was sort of looking after us. And Dot was, she's not that much older than me, you know. She was 12 or something, 11 or something at the time. When these fights would start up, you could hear the voices would start raising. She knew what was going to happen. And she'd get us, the little ones, and she'd take us all, and we'd all climb into the cupboard, in the wardrobe, you know, in her room, and she'd shut the doors, and she'd cover us with, like, I remember she used to cover us with coats, you know. The coats used to smell like my mum's perfume or my dad's cigarettes, you know, and I'd sort of lie there, and it was sort of comforting, but you could hear the muffled sounds outside, and they'd get louder and louder, and then you'd be smashing and things flying around, and we just have to hide in there and wait, you know. And this happened, you know, many times, and then, you know, we'd wait till it was quiet, and you sort of look out, you know, and creep out the out of the cupboard into the kitchen, and, you know, the furniture would be smashed up, there'd be glass of blood, you know, mum would be lying in the corner, you know, dad had gone to the pub, you know. It was just, you know, just full on. It was horrible.
Where else could you go as a little kid that felt safe, Jimmy?
There wasn't many places. There was a paddock across the road from us, which was frightening too. It was really scary, and I'd seen people over there with flashers and, you know, all sorts of stuff. It was a weird place. Some nights I'd climb out the window because these fights were going, and go and sleep in the paddock by myself, you know, until 2 or 3 in the morning, until it was all gone quiet, and then come back in. And, you know, the thing was, you know, I was 7 or 8 years old, and nobody noticed I was missing. You know, they were too busy fighting and drinking to notice it. You know, I used to go and stay with a friend of the family who sort of adopted me, another Scottish family, Mary, and I called her Auntie Mary. And she, I think she just knew that my parents were out of control, and she was just trying to save one of us. She could do a bit. So I used to go and stay with her a bit, and it was just a nice, quiet, normal house. And she had a budgie that she'd talk to, and it was, you know, it was all sweet. But then I go back home, and I have to go back home, and it was just all still the same. One night, it was so bad at home. And, you know, my mum and dad would invite people to parties at the house. And they were just all, you know, when you're addicted to something, you're hanging around with people you would never normally spit on, you know? And so they'd have these really dodgy people in the house, and they'd be looking at you weird and, you know, trying to touch you and, you know, like all this stuff. So I went and stayed with my mate one night, It was about four doors down. That night, his brother had came home and he'd been in jail. I don't know what for, but and at 2 or 3 in the morning, he came into the bedroom and tried to shag both of us. You know, tried to shag me, and I just fought him off and climbed out the window. And you know, we're babies. You know, it was just atrocious. Atrocious way to bring up children. And you know, when I think about that, you know, it explains why all these kids grew up to be like that as teenagers. You know, and a lot of the guys I hung around with, you know, didn't make it out. A lot of them, you know, ended up heroin addicts or died in fights or rotted in jail, you know, for the, you know, beat somebody to death or something. You know, these guys were products of where we grew up.
Jimmy, what changed at home in the summer of 1965-66?
Well, my mum, we woke up one day, mum left, you see. I have mixed emotions about that, you know, because I know I can look back now and say mum left to save her life. We know about domestic violence. You know, you can't stay there and just put up with that sort of stuff. You have to get out. But unfortunately, mum left and left us with my dad. And my dad, who loved us, he was out of control and he couldn't look after us when mum was there. So when she left, it means there was nothing. There was no one to look after us. And my sister Dot was trying to do the best she could. And she was, you know, she'd steal money out of his pockets when he'd come home drunk so she could feed us. You know, I remember we used to buy these big, you know, 5-10 kilo bags of potatoes and we'd drag them up the street and we'd live on that for the week, just the kids. That's all we'd have, just a bag of potatoes. And it was like living in bloody Ireland in the potato famine, you know. My dad was just too busy drinking and the violence got worse then. There was more fights. He might as well have gone as well because we were virtually alone. And the house, well, you know, at least when my mum was there, she sort of tried to keep the place a bit clean, you know, and neat. But my dad and we were too young. We didn't know what to do. And there was, you know, the fights that they had in the house. It was, you know, people's heads put through walls and windows were smashed. Doors were ripped off the hinges. And it was just an unsafe place to be. And that went on for a couple of years. We were there like that. She left us for a couple of years. And I know why she left, but I can't help but think in my heart that she should have taken us.
When did you next see her?
It was a couple of years later. She came back somewhere in the middle of it for a fleeting second. I seen her parked in a car outside the house, and I looked out the window and I knew it was her. And I ran to the door, and as I ran across the front lawn, the car sped off down the street, you know, and I was chased her down the street. It was just horrible. And I didn't see her again for months. And the next time she came, she turned up and she was with some bloke who was a really, really strange bloke. And she took us away for the afternoon to, it was a house. And it's funny because the house where she was staying, right, was where I used to run away when my mum was gone. I'd pinch, you know, 2 bob out of my dad's, you know, pocket because it was lying on the floor. And there'd be people everywhere drunk on the floor. And I'd just sort of tiptoe over, steal 2 bob and leave at 5 in the morning and get a train to the Glenelg jetty. And I'd sit on the jetty and look out to the sea. And I literally, as a 9-year-old sat on the end of, 10-year-old sat on the end of the jetty thinking about committing suicide, you know. And I'd sit there and I think I could just swim out. Nobody would miss me. It's okay, you know. And funnily enough, when my mum was away, she was living just down the road from that jetty. And I'd probably walk past the house, you know. So she came and took us to this house, and I'm looking around. I'm going, oh, this is where I come. I didn't tell anybody. And the house was some fella there. I don't know who. I can't even remember his name, but he was really weird. And he had all these like kids' toys set up in his backyard, and it was all, and I, you know, I just wanted to play with him. And he was really, he didn't want us to touch anything. And he was like looking at us weird. And mum sort of knew something was wrong and took us back that afternoon, and we never see her again for another few months. And then eventually she came back with this guy who was a very strange looking fella, you know, because we're all Scottish, you know, Glaswegians aren't that tall, you know. But she walked up with Reg Barnes, and Reg Barnes was like 6'6" and he was skinny and he had a big nose. And I remember as long as I've known Reg, he wore cardigans, he looked like, you know, Mr. Rogers, you know, the neighborhood, that sort of thing. And he was a really gentle soul. And she came back with Reg, and she just said, oh, you guys are going to come and spend the night with us. And, you know, I didn't realize then, but she obviously had spoke to my father. And we went to the house for the afternoon, and we just never went back.
What was that house like, Jimmy, where she lived with Reg?
We thought it was a palace, you know, because Reg, it was really nice, because by the time my mum took us, you know, for that time, you know, we were like, the mattresses were just like springs sticking out, and they were covered in blood and, you know, piss, and you know, it was a horror. No sheets, and we had blankets from the Salvation Army that were filthy, and we were starving and stuff like that. And we got to Reg's house, and it was, you know, we had bunk beds, and it was really neat with sheets turned down, and it was all, you know, clean towels, and there was food in the fridge. It was really great. And Mum said, "Look, you guys, you're going to have to stay with us." And we all went, "Yeah, okay."
Tell me what Reg would do after he cleared the table after dinner.
Reg is an Aussie from Port Adelaide, Reg. He was very, very straight and very settled in his way. I think he was going to be a priest at one point, you know, but he was really so calm. And everybody cleaned up, and they'd all go to get ready for bed. And I'd be in my pajamas, and he'd grab me and say, "Come here." And we'd go into the kitchen, and he'd set the table for breakfast, which was incredible because we'd, you know, two meals in a row. Who knew? You know, so he'd get me to help him because he always said, "Oh, you've got to do this stuff. You've got to help. You've got to pitch in." And then he used to like eating cereal at night. And so him and I would sit in the kitchen at night and have a bowl of cereal. And we wouldn't talk a lot, but it'd just be like this little moment alone. And he'd smile at me. And you know, sometimes he'd tell me stories. Other times he wouldn't. By the point we moved in with Reg, I was so afraid of, I was like a nervous wreck. I was afraid of everything in it. And I used to wake up in the middle. It must have been a horror story for him, you know, because we were all really bad. You know, and my brother John was a delinquent, and him and my sisters were delinquents. And I was just at the point of becoming one, you know. I was pretty bad. And he knew. And I'd wake up and I'd be screaming and have nightmares and sweating and all this sort of stuff. And he knew I was afraid of the dark. And as soon as he recognized that, he went to his parents' house in Port Adelaide and came back with this. It was like a lighthouse lamp. And it was, you know, it was just really cute. And he put it on my desk and he said, "Lighthouses shine out across the sea to help ships that are lost." He said, "This will do the same for you." And he said his dad gave it to him, you know, and nobody ever gave me anything. And it just broke my heart. Reg was like that. He was one of the only shining lights in my life.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Jimmy, you were telling us how Reg Barnes came into your life and became this protector. But things were still rough with your mum and you were living a pretty wild adolescence. What happened when you were 16?
My mum kept getting drawn back to Elizabeth. As much as Reg wanted to keep us in this nice, you know, picket fence sort of, you know, clean, classic Australian home, you know, like, and by the way, the castle was actually in a place called Wingfield in Adelaide, which was, you know, 100 yards away from a meat tannery. Of a skin tannery, so it just smelled atrocious. There was septic tanks with sewage overflowing, but it was still better than where we were living. But Reg kept the house really neat, but Mum was like drawn like a magnet back to Elizabeth all the time. I think she felt out of place there. She felt ashamed of who she was, and so she wanted to be around people like her. So she kept getting Reg to move back to Elizabeth, and of course, when we moved back to Elizabeth, I just fell back in with all my old mates from school, and that's when I was really running wild in gangs and stuff like that. And we were up to, you know, we were just, you know, out of control, you know, bloody fighting and drinking and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And one day I found out that David Campbell was my son. I was 16 and my band played at the local community center. I was a bass player. And in fact, the night that David was conceived, I think I broke three strings on my bass and I didn't even care because it didn't matter. I wasn't using the other three anyway. But, you know, it wasn't like she was my girlfriend, right? And we didn't, you know, hadn't, you know, been together or anything like that. And the two of us just didn't know what to do. And so David came along and he was born and it was decided that her mother was going to adopt David and she brought him up. I wasn't capable of doing it anyway. I was, you know, 16 and I was completely out of control and just starting to escalate. So by the time I was ready to really be a parent, it was many, many, many years later. But I always knew that I had a son and I'd go and visit. You know, I wasn't allowed to say that I was his dad because the grandmother just wanted to protect him, I guess. But it was a bit really difficult. And I'd go there and I was sort of the, who's this guy? You know, and David would be sent to, you know, to come away with me for the weekend and stuff. And by this point, I was in a band and I was in Colchester and I was, you know, arriving in leather jackets and, you know, in limousines and stuff like that. And who's the drunken uncle with a limo?
Well, tell me, as you say, you're starting to play in bands, and I think, again, at just 16, you're asked to audition for this new band who go on to become Cold Chisel. Where was that audition held?
One of those times where I was at the shopping centre and looked for people to have fights with. And I'm standing there with the gang, we're all hanging out. And this guy walked up and he didn't look like he belonged. He was a bit of a hippie, and you know, which would have made him a target, you know, but he came straight up to me for some reason. He was lucky he didn't do it with one of the other boys because they would have killed him. And he knew that my brother, John had a bit of a reputation. As John had been in bands since he was like 12. And this guy came up and said, oh, look, we're getting a band together and we're looking for a singer and we're here. You'll be okay. You might be as good as your brother. So I looked at him and, he was sort of real hippie, you know, red eyes, you know, he looked like he smoked too much dope and his long hair and his glasses. And it did look like he didn't fit in with my gang. And I thought, well, this is the sort of guy, so, you know, I don't think I'm going to fit in here. But he gave me a piece of paper and said, come to this address on Saturday if you're interested. And then he quickly got out, you know, which was a wise thing to do. And I just shoved it in my pocket. I wasn't going to go. And then I'm standing there, you know, and it was sort of one of these moments where you get a bit of clarity. And I'm standing there and I looked at myself and I'm, you know, 16 years old. And I spend every night of the week hanging around outside a snooker hall waiting to fight with somebody I don't even know. And I just thought to myself, what am I doing? You know, what am I here for? What's this about? So I thought, I'm going to go. I'm going to go up to, and they gave me an address. It was in the city. Got the train up into town. Very nervous because I've been in bands, but only bands that I started and were kids, and I'd never really auditioned. So I was really nervous and I didn't take rejection well. You know, I was on the edge and I'd had a big night and I found a place, and it was the Women's Liberation Hall in Adelaide, which I thought immediately they're taking the piss out of me here, you know?
I had no idea that Cold Chisel started in the Women's Liberation Hall in Adelaide.
We rehearsed there for a long, long time. And they were really great. I mean, the women that ran this hall were fantastic. And we respected them and we loved having the space to rehearse. But I got there and I didn't want to come on. And anyway, I walked upstairs and sure enough, there was a band in there waiting to rehearse. They were nothing like my mates. Don was, you know, he looked like a uni student. He was, you know, he was a physics student. You know, Ian was a country boy from Mossy, was a country boy from Alice Springs. And Les, the guy who started Cold Chisel, Les Kaczmarek, was a tall, good looking, you know, Polish bass player with big flares and really shiny gear. And, you know, none of my bands had any equipment. You know, we couldn't afford it. And I remember going in and I was really nervous. And I think Ian or someone said, oh, do you know any songs by Free? And they were my favorite band in the world. I knew every song. So I said, yeah, I know a couple. So we sang a few songs and immediately they let me join the band. You know, I was like 16 and a half at that point, and that changed my life. It was sort of my ticket out. You know, standing in that corner, waiting to fight people didn't make any sense to me, and it hadn't ever made sense to me. You know, it's like fate just all fell together and I went, okay, I'm out. And if Cold Chisel hadn't come along, I think I would have just, you know, jumped on a train or hitchhiked out. And God knows what I would have done. I reckon, like a lot of my mates, I probably would have been dead by now if I hadn't joined Cold Chisel.
The first album, the band's first album, came out in early 1979. Who did you meet in November of that year?
I remember, you know, November 29th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I remember seeing Jane, my now wife. We were touring with the Angels, and we're all mates. We're managed by the same company. We're all touring together. And you know, it was us and Flowers, who were to become Ice House later. And anyway, the Angels had some friends in Canberra, and we were in Canberra, Jeroboamba Avenue, Motel 7, I think it was. And we walked in, they were all just all, you know, I think they were stoners, they were all going in and smoked pot. And I didn't smoke much pot, you know, I didn't like downers, I liked uppers, you know. So I walked in, and as soon as I walked in the room, I'd seen this girl across the room, and she was just beautiful. And she took my breath away. I went out the room again and sort of got myself together, but, you know, tidied myself up, but I wanted to be impressive, but I wasn't. She wouldn't even look at me, didn't say a word. She didn't say a word to anybody in the room. I sat there really quiet, and I'd never seen anybody look like her. She could have been from anywhere, but she was so exotic and so beautiful. And anyway, that, you know, and I was sort of smitten from the minute I seen her. But that night we did a show at the university in Canberra, ANU. The Angels and Cold Chisel were doing this tour where one night they'd be on last, one night we'd be on last. It was like a double bill. As it happened, I'd played first with Cold Chisel, and then I was standing on the side of the stage watching the Angels. And this girl suddenly was there next to me. And I looked and I was like, nervous, you know. and she invited me to a party. And I was, you know, I wasn't sure. Yeah, I didn't know what to think, you know, because how bloody thick I was. You know, when she didn't speak or say anything, she was so, I thought maybe she didn't speak English, you know. And that's a bit offensive. But she spoke five languages, you know. She speaks English better than I did. but she invited me to this party at a friend's place. And Cold Chisel had a drummer who was standing in for Steve Presswick. And the drummer was Trevor Young. He was from the Lobby Lloyd's Colored Balls. We were a skinhead band. And he was an absolute animal at the time. And him and I went to this party together. And it was a really nice, beautiful suburban Canberra house. When the parents were upstairs, you know, and letting the kids have a party. And him and I got there and I was being best behavior. I was trying to impress this girl, you know. And I went in and I was like, you know, I was already drunk when she came up and spoke to me, but I tried not to get any more drunk. So I went and sat next to her and I was trying to be impressive to her. And in the meantime, my mate was trashing the fin joint. And I'm sitting there and Jane, I remember Jane was really, really cute and really nice. And she was just, you know, not like, you know, I didn't know many people like her. And at one point she said, oh, I play music. And she knew about four chords at that point. And she played Puff the Magic Dragon to me. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, are you serious? This is just in my internal dialogue. I'm going, I can't believe this girl. Is she really playing this bloody song? And anyway, that was great. You know? And then my mate had caused too much trouble and they threw us out. And I thought I'd never see her again. And she said, oh, give me a number and I'll call you tomorrow. And I thought, I'm getting the elbow here. We've tossed out. They called me a cab. And I thought I'd never see her again. I was a bit heartbroken. And sure enough, she seen me the next day. She came to the airport where we were flying out. And then she gave me her number. And then I stalked her till she went out.
Well, it worked. You must have made an impression. You got married. You started having kids. And at the same time in your life, Cold Chisel is getting bigger and bigger. Yeah. The band breaks up and then your solo career just gets bigger and bigger. And you're making number ones and you're making a huge amount of money. And what were you spending all your money on back then?
Oh, I was out of control. I mean, really, I spent a lot of money on drugs and booze, and I wasted the rest. No, sorry. That's an old joke, but you've got to get it in. I wanted to buy my kids everything I didn't have. And Jane, funnily enough, Jane realized that I didn't talk much about my past because I was ashamed of where I came from. But Jane knew that I was poor and I didn't have a lot. And so she wanted to give me everything that she had. So it was like Jane lavishing things on me and me lavishing things on our kids. So we bought a farm with beautiful recording studio and, you know, there was nannies and karate instructors and cooks and we had bloody everybody. And once we made money, everybody we knew had money, you know, because we were very, very generous. And I built this house, which was way too big for what we needed and spent way too much money on it. So I was virtually touring, trying to pay back loans, you know, and it was like, it was making me work and I didn't work, wasn't working for the right reasons. So Jane just said, let's just get rid of it all. So, we sort of filed for chapter 11 or whatever it is and sort of went to bankruptcy and sold everything. Paid off all the debts, you know, paid everybody we could and moved away to France.
It's kind of amazing listening to your story and reading your books, Jimmy, is how you managed to keep functioning and keep performing and keep making albums given the intensity of your addictions during these periods. So tell me about the Sydney Olympics. You ended, you were the final act in the closing of the Sydney Olympics. What was going on that night?
You've got to remember that as soon as I realised that music got me away from the life I'd been brought up with, I was never going back. And I was either going to die, you know, trying or keep. And I just kept plowing forward. No matter what I threw at myself, no matter what the world threw at me, I'm a hard person to knock down. And I'm tense, I'm hyperactive, and I'm driven. If something fails, you get up, pick yourself up, and you charge again, and you keep going till you knock it in. You know, and that's the way I approach the music business. I'm relentless. You know, people say, you know, what are you doing? I made three records in a year or something. You know, and I just keep throwing them out there, and I keep working hard. But at the same time, a lot of that was drug fueled, you know, and the work I'd do would suffer because of it, you know. But I just kept picking myself up, you know, when I couldn't see anymore, and I'd throw another pile of rocket fuel into me and go again. So by the time the 2000 Olympics came, I was an absolute mess. I was taking so many drugs, and they wanted me to sing at the closing ceremony, and it was, you know, a big honor, a big gig, and I didn't want to let everybody down. And I remember I had to share a dressing room, which was like a sports, you know, bathroom sort of thing. I was sharing a dressing room with Slim Dusty, Paul Hogan and Greg Norman. And like, they're all in there, you know, and they're really, they're all proper. And I'm just, I was waste. I hadn't been to bed when I got there. I was going at the bathroom and doing lines of cocaine. And I was in the shower cubicle smoking hashish. And
with Slim Dusty in the same room, Jimmy.
At one point, because I was getting ready to go on, and I warm up very unconventionally. I'll scream a lot, you know. So I'm screaming like a banshee, like really loud. And this big security guy bursts in, right? And he goes, "What's going on?" And I look around the room, and there's only Slim there. Slim's sitting there, but really quiet. He's got his hat on his lap like that. And I said, "It's him. He's an animal." And Slim was really sweet. And I couldn't believe it, because, Slim was a legend. And it was a gentle, beautiful soul, right? And he said to me, "Oh, you know, I'd really like to do a duet with you one day. You know, what's that song you sing about Vietnam? You know, you wanted to do a duet with K-Slam." Imagine if I had done K-Slam with Slim Dusty. It would have been fabulous. We just never got the chance to do it.
I want to hear that. Absolutely. I mean, it's funny, Jimmy, like, they're mad stories. And I'm so glad that you didn't, you know, forget the words to Working Class Man in front of 8 billion people or whatever could have gone wrong. But my gosh, you must look back and think, I was really flying close to the wind then. Like, that must have been, there must have been a lot of pain driving that kind of behaviour.
All I wanted to do was escape myself. I didn't like me, and I didn't like where I came from, and I didn't like what was eating away inside me, and I didn't want to look at it. And the more I medicated, the more I drank, the more I ran, the less I had to look at myself. And it took a point where I kept running, and it's one of those, I learned this lesson where, you know, it took me a long, long time that, you know, you can't run away from anything. If you're running from anything in the world, eventually you're going to trip, or it's going to catch you. You're going to have to, the best thing you can do is turn and face it. And that's the last thing I wanted to do. And I ran for as long and as hard as I could until I couldn't run anymore. And so that's when I started to work and really get help. And it was funny, as soon as I cleaned up my act, I, you know, like, once that was healed, you know, I can look back, you know, still just as painful to look at it. And, you know, and there's times where I stand and look in the mirror and just wonder how, you know, what happened, you know, I'm so lucky to be here. But if I hadn't have done that, I would have certainly been gone.
You had a couple of stints in rehab, including a month in Arizona in the States. How hard is that to go through, to go cold turkey?
You know what? Going for rehab to work for you, you have to go knowing that it's not for anything else, for any other reason except to help yourself. You know, I was going because everybody wanted me to. You know, and so I went there and I go, "Oh, yeah, bloody, I can put up with this, you know, for a month, you know." And there was, it drove me nuts, you know, and they were all bloody, you know, kumbaya and, you know, holding hands and sitting in the desert. I'm going to punch holes in your aura, you know. But it was really, you know, I got straight, and then I got out, and then eventually I drifted back into what I was doing. I went back into another rehab and drifted back into what I was doing. But every time I did something, I learned something. I'd had collected enough knowledge, even unwillingly, you know. I mean, all the way through, Jane was always there supporting me, and, you know, bringing bloody, you know, Buddhist monks up to the house and giving me blessings, and Deepak Chopra used to come and hang out with me and try to talk sense into me, you know. And all the way through, all these little things that this really beautiful community of people gave me left me with little bits of you know, ammunition to fight. And when it came to the point where I really needed it, I did it myself. And it was because I'd gathered all this information and had so much love and help from other people. So I was a really lucky, lucky person. And I am a lucky person.
Flame Trees is a Cold Chisel song about going back to your hometown. What's it been like for you to sing that song over the years?
Different times, different things. You know, it's always been, it's always been a beautiful song. It's a lovely melody. I mean, I taught Rock and Roll 101 at Berklee College of Music in Boston. I mean, my son was a graduate from there, and they invited me to teach a rock and roll band how to put a rock and roll band together. And one of the teachers was using the songwriting teachers was using Flame Trees as a description of a perfect song. It was written by Steve Presrich and Don Walker. And after he died, it became really, really difficult to sing. And so, you know, I used to sing that song quite often, you know, most nights, have a big lump in my throat, and it was really difficult. Of late, you know, since writing, it's become a bit easier because I can appreciate the song for the beauty of what it is. But I also had this other epiphany. I went back recently to Elizabeth. I was on tour, and I was going to do a show in the Barossa Valley, and I drove through Elizabeth. And Jane was with me. And every time I went to Elizabeth since I was a kid, the sense of pain and fear, and it was like a weight all over, like a blanket thrown all over me. And I remember this time I went back and I got there and it didn't look any different. It was more falling down. It was more graffiti and it looked worse and all that sort of stuff. But I felt a sense of belonging. But I remembered sort of standing there and my mates playing football and you know, and us against the world. And I remember my brother singing to me and it was just suddenly I felt like I was home. And it was a really strange, I called it a broken homecoming. The whole cycle, I'd gone round and I'd let go of all that stuff. And Elizabeth wasn't the problem. We were the problem.
You've got 7 kids counting at the moment, grandkids, great-grandson. Given the way you were raised,
two great-grandsons.
Given the way that you were raised, has it been hard knowing how to parent, how to be a patriarch in a big family like that?
I tried to be a good supplier, you know, be encouraging, you know, even through my darkest days. I was, you know, like I was, you know, drug addict, you know, rock and roll star, bloody drunken, you know, 7 number one albums in a row and still coaching the under 7 football team, you know. But I tried my best all the time to be as good as I could. But, you know, of course, looking back, I can see so many things I did wrong as a parent. I know for my kids, talking to them now as adults, they, you know, they sat and they were watching and worried about me every day. And that's abuse in its own way, you know, and that's something that I have to learn to live with, you know, since I've grown through that, you know, we spoke about it a lot and it doesn't make it any easier. You know, Mahalia used to come on tour with me, you know, and she told me that there was a point there where she used to dread getting up in the morning and going knocking on my door because she just thought I wouldn't be awake. I'd be dead. You know, and to put your daughter through that is a horrible thing. That's as much abuse as what I receive from my family.
I think about it though, Jimmy, when you describe either hiding in that wardrobe with your siblings or taking off across the paddock by yourself, like you were so alone as a kid, but you've built this big clan, you've built this big tribe of people who love you.
Yeah, and the thing is, what I realized was I had built all this stuff around me and had people who loved me, but I wouldn't let them in until not so long ago. You know, I was always waiting for everybody going, you're not good enough. I was waiting for people to see the real me and go, we don't like you. And, you know, because I didn't like me. It's taken a long, long time for me to get to the point where I can breathe now and allow, you know, myself to feel that love and to see it and feel like I deserve it or whatever. And that's not a sob story. So I was always ready just to smash and move on. Just like my parents, really. When I think about it, I was always ready just to put my hands up and fight my way out and just, you know, and leave everything. You know, if it all came to the worst, I'd just storm off. And I realized that. And once I dropped my guard, I could start to feel the love. And life is so much easier.
For everyone, I bet, around you.
For everybody.
And when I think about that, the early drive to sing was partly about that battle, partly about that posture of taking on the world. What drives you singing now? What do you call on when you make music now?
I used to tap into so much pain and fear and love and hope and anger all the time when I sang. I was singing Don Walker's lyrics, you know, in early Cold Chisel days. And I thought he was reading my mail, you know. It was like, you know, I'd read so much into them. And I'd automatically, when I'd say, oh, I want to be angry, I could just go, boom, I'm there. Because I could just tap into it. And that was unhealthy because I didn't know what I was doing. So now, I try to bypass my brain. You know? I don't want to think. I want to feel an emotion, it comes out in the way I sing. I draw on the pain that I felt. I draw on the anger with myself and the fear and the same things, only the difference is I'm aware of it now and it's easier to access. And I think because of that, I'm a better singer. And I feel now that I'm singing better than I have in my whole career. I feel, you know, I'm more rewarded from the same. When I sing, I feel I've done something, you know, I feel like I've connected with someone. It's not about blocking or charging or just, you know, I was trying to get in people's faces saying, get away from me, you know, every minute of my life, you know, for 50 years.
Not anymore. Jimmy, it's so great to talk to you. Thanks so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Anytime.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, it's Richard here with a podcast recommendation. If you're keen to get some lively family discussions happening over the dinner table or on long car trips, then this could be the podcast for you and your kids. Short and Curly is an ethics show about life's tricky ethical questions. And hosts Molly and Carl have a new season.
Ho, 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 so much to do. I've got to fuel the pixie dust tank on the sleigh, polish Rudolph's nose, and stop the elves from unionising.
Santa?
Carl, you've got to hide.
Santa!
Carl, what are you doing? No!
Santa, it's me, Carl Smith. Remember me? I send you a letter every year.
Carl, what are you doing here? And how did you get past the polar bears?
Ah, yes, the polar bears. Short and Curly, the kids' podcast for the whole family. Download it from the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.